We're talking about the rise of home meth labs and a portrait of one Missouri county that became the epicenter of a destructive cottage industry. You're with us for an hour-long conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. 15 years ago, anthropologist Jason Pine was a newly minted PhD. He was on his first teaching job at University of Missouri in Columbia. And as he describes it, the pay was low, the teaching load high. But one thing was a continual distraction as he went about his life. Home meth labs, meth cooking, was transforming the way people lived, worked, and died all around him. And the anthropologist in him couldn't help but amass interviews and materials. What questions do you have about methamphetamine and how it affects a community? We're at 800-642-1234. Jason Pine is an anthropology and media studies professor at Purchase College, State University of New York. His new book is called The Alchemy of Meth, A Decomposition. Jason, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks so much for the invitation.
You describe St. Jude, and this is a county that you make up the name for, St. Jude. It's a really extraordinary place. What makes it a compelling community to study as an anthropologist?
Well, as you mentioned in your introduction, I noticed that there was a high frequency of home meth labs in the state. Looking at the statistics and talking to people, I noticed that there was one county in particular that had an extraordinarily high number of busts every year for about a decade, so much higher than the number two county within the state, and the state itself having an extraordinarily high number of busts compared to the rest of the country. So in a sense, yes, according to the statistics, the county that I zeroed in on was an epicenter. And I say according to the statistics because that is kind of definitely a dubious status, because statistics don't really tell the truth. And that's another topic.
Well, in what ways was this community similar to what was happening in other parts of the country, so that your research might provide a window into a broader pattern for our society?
Well, what people were experiencing and still experiencing in many parts of the Midwest and other parts of the United States more generally that are undergoing a process of deindustrialization. Often we think about deindustrialization as something that has ended, a process of shifting from manual labor, factory work, to more service industry or information society type of labor as being a completed process. But there are many parts of the United States where that's an ongoing process, meaning that there are still factories, some of them operating, some of them not, but people are still transitioning out of that lifestyle, out of that labor, and not finding a proper replacement. And so, meaning that replacement jobs in the service industry or information industries are not coming into the area and replacing those jobs, or if they are, they're not providing a proper living wage so that people can get by. And also there are factories that are still there and still producing a kind of ecological injury that are affecting the health, that is affecting the health of residents. So this economic shift has created a lot of precarity for a lot of people. And meth has filled a gap in particular ways for a lot of people.
We're talking about meth this hour with your questions and stories along the way. Our guide is anthropologist Jason Pine. His new book is called The Alchemy of Meth, A Decomposition. You can join in 800-642-1234. Jason, the book is a collection of these vignettes of people in different pieces of their lives. How did you connect with meth users who allowed you into their life and an ability for you to follow them?
Yeah, it's a good question. It was a very difficult process because well, of course, people who are engaged in an illicit activity, manufacture or even use of an illicit drug, are suspicious of outsiders and their intentions. And the identity of an anthropologist is really hard to explain to anybody. I mean, what on earth is a person doing hanging out for months and months, even years, alongside people interested in what they do and not interested in busting them or collaborating with law enforcement, not a journalist who often may want the identities of people or the identity of the place, or this is the imaginary that people have of journalists in these sorts of environments, someone looking for a scoop. So I had to deal with the automatic suspicion of being a stranger in a place and not having any business being there. So one thing that did help me a great deal was at the university where I taught, I had a graduate student whose mother was caring for a meth user, a cook, who was dying of cancer. And she herself was not a user, but worked as a bartender and knew several users. And they trusted her. And she offered to allow me to help her to care for this individual and introduce me to others. So she became a sort of ambassador to the scene and could translate my motives for them and calm them somewhat. But it didn't always work. People get paranoid from the drug itself, experience a lot of hallucinations, feel that they're being persecuted. So there was a lot of failed opportunities in the research.
You've struggled yourself with addiction, and you write about yourself in the third person. What was it like to go deep into this world of meth cooking, knowing that you too are vulnerable?
Yeah, I actually didn't have in the forefront of my mind my own experiences. And what you're referring to is my long-term use of ADHD medication, particularly amphetamine salts or Adderall, which is of the same class of drugs called amphetamines, which includes methamphetamine. So they're phenomenologically the same drug. So oddly enough, I didn't connect my own use of this drug to what I was observing. But of course it was operative. Of course it was motivating me. Of course it is what piqued my interest and my concern about what was going on. And the more that I did the research, there were moments when users would turn to me and say, I think there's something more about why you're doing this research. There's something personal in this. And eventually I had to face that myself and talk about it and realize that talking about it was a politically important act. Because if you only talk about people who are using meth in a particular region, in a particular socioeconomic class, you're scapegoating them and you're singling them out. And what became important for me was to draw the connection between what's going on in one place among a certain kind of people and vastly other types of regions and socioeconomic classes with other drugs.
We're talking with author and anthropologist Jason Pine, taking us to the voices of people in northeastern Missouri, a county that was a hotbed for home meth lab manufacturing. Your questions, your stories about your community, they're welcome. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about rural Missouri and the plight of people who are caught up in home meth labs, especially in the early 2000s. The new book is called The Alchemy of Meth. We're spending the hour here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Anthropologist Jason Pine was living and working in Missouri at the time. He talked with almost 100 people to better understand meth's pervasiveness, he visited food pantries, he visited trash dumps and big box stores, hundreds of home meth labs, busted and active, all to get closer to his material, to understand how meth was eroding systems, how it was destroying people's lives. Are health and law enforcement authorities giving enough attention to drug problems in your community? Should lawmakers be doing more to help? What actions do you want to see happen? Join in the conversation any point, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And anthropology professor Jason Pine stays with us. So, Jason, you describe your book as going against the grain of academia, these fragmented, incomplete stories. I like to see them as vignettes. But why did you decide to approach writing about meth in this way?
Yeah, there were many reasons. It took me a long time to actually put this material together into a book. First of all, I was perplexed by the goal of anthropology or academia in general, generally privileged people who sometimes studied less privileged people, people in difficult situations, published books that very few people read because, for example, they're published by academic presses that generally don't market books well enough that they reach large audiences, but also because academics themselves have a hard time or are a lack of interest in writing in an accessible way that, you know, makes it available to a general public, including the people that they're writing about. So one thing that I felt was important was to let the stories sit as they are, and let the stories do their own work. And they are fragmented in life. Life is a fragmented and undirected and inconclusive experience for a lot of people. And particularly if you're in the precarious situation where you're using a drug and recovery and relapse are a regular occurrence, I didn't want to give the sense of closure that doesn't really exist for many people.
Let's take a call now. Scott is joining us from Waukesha. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
So I teach about cultural factors such as poverty that are related to drug use and drug production. And I come from northern Alabama originally. And there's been a big problem with meth there. And there's also this long-term tradition of people making moonshine alcohol, which is also illegal. And there are pop culture references like James McMurtry's Choctaw Bingo to people who make moonshine and also make meth. And I was just curious from an anthropologist's perspective if there's any connection there or if this is just a myth.
Scott, thank you for that question. Jason, what do you see there? Can you connect it in any way?
Yeah, I have noticed that connection too. Moonshine is a cottage industry just like meth cooking, meaning that these aren't large-scale operations, but manufacturing processes that occur in the home and that go against the grain of the law and produce a substance for personal use or to share with friends or to sell, and widespread and filling a gap in some way. I don't know a lot about moonshine, if that was also or is also a way to supplement one's income, but meth definitely is. But the structure, the economic structure of it as a cottage industry is very similar.
How you go into how meth is made, where were people getting their recipes or how are they learning how to cook?
Yeah. People learn in prison. People learn as apprentices to other cooks. I mean, you might be a user, you might be a neighbor or an acquaintance who wants to learn, and you hook up with a cook and you get trained in it. There's also a lot of information on the internet. And sinisterly, there's also a lot of false information on the internet, meaning that there are recipes that are guaranteed to produce an explosion. So it's hit or miss, but usually recipes are passed through people from person to person in a kind of an apprenticeship form of communication.
We're discussing how meth affects communities and concerns about the drug. Your guide is Jason Pine. He's an anthropologist. His new book is The Alchemy of Meth, A Decomposition. Join in, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about meth? What do you want to know about the drug's effects? What do you want to know about treatment options and where people go for help? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Owen now, joining us from Waiwega. Hi, Owen.
Yeah, hi. So I lived down in the Aquitex there in Louisiana, Texas, and Arkansas for about 4 or 5 years. And I knew some real successful business owners that ate meth, you know, and that's a whole different way of doing it than smoking or injecting. They kind of know how to control their dosage a little more, so they kind of can remain in the public eye, not under the influence, but they use it, you know, to get through their day, like somebody might use Adderall. But then there's other people, you know, they get real fired out on it when they smoke or shoot it. But I didn't know anybody that cooked it, because it comes in and it's so cheap. It's like the new crack. It's just everywhere down there. I mean, you can get a large quantity of it for little to nothing. You know, a person can get by on $20 a day of a habit and stay awake for, you know, days and days and days.
Oh, and
my sister-in-law, she struggles with it. She'll go on and off it. She goes to, well, she went to rehab, but that's the biggest problem. She's in poverty, so she can't afford to stay in a treatment facility, and the state of Arkansas only put her in treatment for like 30 days. That was just long enough for her to basically sleep.
And I want to pause right there, because you bring up a lot of issues here. Jason Pine, one being poverty, another being access to the drug at a low cost.
Yeah, a lot of what this caller, Owen, is saying resonates with things that I've heard as well. People do use the drug to enhance their labor. And eating it is one discrete way as well. It doesn't look like you're using a drug. I've heard of people stuffing it in balls of Wonder Bread or peanut butter that they can just eat regularly on the job. It is a slower kind of high, and it is a sustaining kind of high. But the important thing is that it is used to enhance one's labor, to make someone capable of working longer hours or to withstand the boredom of a job, because the effects of meth are such that the increase of dopamine in the brain makes repetitive activity actually interesting and engaging.
Owen also mentions getting help and access to treatment. In the people you talked with, were they interested in those resources?
Yes, absolutely. And the problem is that treating meth addiction is very, very difficult. The relapse is very, very common and likely. And specialists in recovery professionals say that at least 2 years are needed for treatment in order to be somewhat sure that someone is out of the clear, in the clear, and able to avoid relapse. But there are no facilities, at least in Missouri, that will give you that type of long-term treatment.
You watched people inject themselves with the drug. How did they behave differently before and after injecting?
Yeah, well, meth gives you a surge, first an initial euphoria, but then afterwards one feels, and this is the seductive thing about meth, actually feels not intoxicated, but more alert, more alive, more capable, courageous, interested, and hopeful. And this is, I say, seductive in a very sinister way, because people feel that they're now fitting into their shoes better, and they're taking on the challenges of everyday life with much more courage and ability, including working at your job or engaging in some kind of entrepreneurial activity. And this is what makes meth quite a problem, because it syncs up with some of the desires that many of us share.
Pausing there with anthropologist Jason Pine as our guide, how has meth affected your life or your community? Are you trying to help a family member or friend? What is that journey like? 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this after a news update here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A heads up on our programming plans today. The Senate impeachment trial of President Trump resumes at noon, as White House lawyers have one more day to present their defense before questioning begins. You can hear live NPR coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio's News and Classical Network and online at WPR.org. Here in the Ideas Network, we will keep you up to date on the latest and we'll invite you to join the conversation. Right now, we're talking about the dangerous world of home meth production and the voices of people in rural Missouri. It became the epicenter of home meth lab busts for nearly a decade. Anthropologist Jason Pine interviewed about 100 people and collected materials. He visited exploded trailers to try to fill out his portrait of a Midwest landscape and a county really decimated by home meth labs. What questions do you have about meth? What do you want to know about the drug's effects? What do you want to know about treatment options? How has your community responded? Join in 800-642-1234. Jason Pine is a professor of anthropology and media studies at Purchase College, State University of New York, and his new book is called The Alchemy of Meth, A Decomposition, and he stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now. Chris is with us from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my time to take my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to kind of, give agreeance to what your guest speaker has said about the seductive part and how you may feel and you may actually even do, better, or, you'll have more energy. You'll have all the things that, come with it at the beginning. And then why wouldn't you, anybody be, appealed to continue doing that, to feel like they're, above average or doing better or whatnot, and have all that more energy. But then you get used to that, but it may be the case in the beginning, but the longer and the more you go down that road, that's not the case. You're not doing better and whatnot, but when you're not making those endorphins and all that, and you're chemically putting them in, then to get back off of that and then to go back to everyday normal sober life, I think that's one of the biggest challenges then. Is to get back to that normal and feel like, and to come full circle and realize that your better version of yourself is actually the sober, clear-headed version. So,
Chris, thank you so much for those thoughts. Jason?
Yeah, that's sadly very true. That kind of feeling of exhilaration that you're on it, you're more than sober, you're alert, it can't be sustained. Things unravel around you. You're overly confident. You're making mistakes at work. You're making huge mistakes in your life, endangering yourself and people around you. But you don't notice. And things begin to fall apart. And as the caller is saying, the high is not the same. It becomes more a maintenance of some kind of very low ground zero, where you need the drug just to stay awake, just to function, and it starts to work against you. And trying to retrace your steps back to who you originally were, that's very difficult, because actually you've reconstituted who you are. Your brain itself is deeply affected by the drug.
Jason, what kind of health problems did you see in the people you followed?
People get distracted by the sense of frenetic activity that they want to be engaged in from caring for themselves. So a lot of malnourishment, poor hygiene. There is a phenomenon that's called meth mouth. It's not actually caused by the meth itself. Speaking to dentists, I've learned this. But the fact that you don't brush your teeth and you don't salivate as much, and saliva is good for killing bacteria in the mouth. You're also drinking a lot of sugary drinks, caffeinated drinks. So that contributes to the rotting of teeth. And people also tend to scratch themselves. There's a kind of reaction to high levels of dopamine that is similar to what happens in animals that are experimented on with meth, that they over-groom. So this kind of scratching will create sores that you become infected. But then cooking meth itself is a very dangerous thing that can cause explosions and severe burns. That's another whole set of health problems.
What about the children caught up in this? You saw the lives of some children. What was that like?
Yeah, very disturbing. Children are neglected, or worse, they're abused. They're living in homes that are highly toxic and prone to having a lot of traffic, people coming in and out, so all kinds of strangers, amped up, a lot of them sexual, their sexual interest peaked. Pornography plays a role in a lot of these homes as well. A lot of narcotics agents would say that there are three things you always find in a meth lab are guns, porn, and arrowheads. Arrowheads, because there are a lot, or used to be a lot, in the region, and people have a lot of time while they're waiting for their meth lab to produce the meth. They go out into the woods and look for arrowheads. But pornography, sexual activity can lead to abuse, or there can be much more direct abuse. I've heard terrible stories about users, adults, who want to feel closer to their children and so feed the children drugs so that they share that joy.
Let's take another call. Let's go to Peter in Southeast Wisconsin. Hi, Peter.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
It dawned on me that with the professor going and visiting all these people doing the research, there was a certain amount of exposure on his part and on the part of the people that he's studying, that he's working with. It would seem to me in a small community, the police kind of know who's doing what if it happens on a repeated basis. I suspect that they would know what the professor was doing too, and didn't that cause some jeopardy for him or for the people he was visiting?
Peter, great question. Jason, how did you navigate that, and how much were police involved in these meth labs?
Yeah, that is a great question. This isn't the first project I've done that's been in the margins of legality. And my process is to initially contact police and let them know what my intentions are in case they were to do a bust and find me somewhere. And let them know not only that I'm doing research and I'm not engaged in the activity, but also that I'm not willing to collaborate with them, that I'm not gathering information that I'm going to share with them, just to set things clear. And then I don't spend time with police again after that, if not at the very end of the research, because it's just not a good idea to be working both sides or be seen with police when you're working with people who are avoiding the police. So that works. They understand my intentions, and they understand that I'm not an investigative, I'm not a narcotics agent. I don't have that kind of investigative ability. So the kind of information I gather anyway is not going to be of much use to them.
What types of information were you gathering and the pieces of things you were gathering? Because you visited homes destroyed by meth explosions. What did you find there?
Well, there was one instance that what really stood out to me is so in this county, the sheriff's office published all of the addresses of all the locations where meth busts had occurred year per year. So I decided to visit all of them in one year. I think it was the year 2012. And one of the addresses that I visited had an active meth lab, and I was confused. Is this actually active? Was this busted? If it's busted, why is all this equipment here? And so I did speak to narcotics agents at the end of my research period then and asked about that particular address. And he said, no, of course, we gather all evidence and study it and clean up the scene. So you found a reactivated meth lab. That was one thing that was startling, is that when a space is abandoned or busted and sealed, it doesn't remain sealed. People go into it, into the home, into the trailer. They either strip it of all recyclable material, because that's money, or they use it as a place to cook.
How do these explosions happen, and how bad are they?
Yeah, well, this newer recipe, and I'm not remembering the year exactly, maybe 2008, 2007, that emerged, is the smaller scale type of meth lab. It's all condensed in a single 2-liter plastic soda bottle or Gatorade bottle. And while that may seem like a smaller risk than a mega lab, which involves larger equipment and produces larger quantities of meth, this kind of lab is something that someone has to hold in their arms and shake repeatedly over the course of 2 hours in order to speed the reaction inside the bottle, and then open the bottle periodically to release pressure. If you miss a step there, if you allow too much pressure to build up in the bottle, it'll explode. And where does it explode? But in your face, your lap, your upper body region. And that's acid fire. So these are severe burns.
We have to pause there with anthropologist Jason Pine with us. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing meth abuse, the struggles of a rural Missouri county that was disfigured by the dangerous world of home cooking. Anthropologist Jason Pine lived and worked in the northeastern Missouri county he calls St. Jude in the early 2000s. His new book is a compilation of voices of people whose lives have been upended by the drug. How has your community responded to meth labs and their cleanup? Are the addiction resources adequate where you live? How do you see the impact of meth today? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Jason Pine's book is called The Alchemy of Meth, and he stays with us. Jason, you described home cooks waiting for the garbage truck with their trash by their side on garbage collection days. What did the trash heaps and the dumps look like?
Sometimes the trash from meth labs had a lot of burned aerosol cans and plastic bottles, which didn't really conceal what they were. So that was sort of a senseless act of trying to conceal the evidence of cooking. Sometimes there were cooks that just simply didn't take out the trash. It would just build up inside. So a lot of meth labs are incredibly filthy and unlivable conditions. And this is paranoia about people going through the trash and finding out what's going on inside.
Where do people get their meth now?
Yeah, one of the callers mentioned this, that meth is now much more available as an already produced product that doesn't, you don't need to manufacture it in your home. It's quite cheap, and it's coming from super labs in Mexico, maybe other South and Central American countries, and has reached now other regions of the U.S. rather than major metropoles, including the region that I studied. So meth is much more readily available and cheap, and is one doesn't need to make it.
How does it compare today with what people used and cooked in the early 2000s?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I spoke to a lot of older veteran cooks, and they say that there's a different quality to what was then called speed, or something that was produced by bikers, like Hell's Angels, that there was a different kind of kick to it. It had a more bodily effect. It made your limbs kind of jerk and gave you a certain kind of physical push. Whereas today's meth had a more euphoric feeling to it and wasn't as bodily. They also talked about a different kind of burn when you ingested it, if you snorted it, or even injected it. But others would say that it's stronger and purer now, especially if it's coming from a super lab.
We're running out of time, but I'm just wondering, have you been in contact with any of the people that you shadowed in your book? Do you keep up any of those relationships?
Yes, I do as much as I can. It's difficult. People disappear. People go to prison. People jump bail. People just don't have access to a computer, internet, or phone. But yes, I do keep in contact, and I do have plans to return there and give some talks to the communities and invite people to participate and share my book with them.
With the people that you do stay in contact with, have their lives changed that much or at all? Are they still addicted to meth?
Well, a lot of them are. Some of them have stayed off, but then other tragedies hit them. For example, one guy I've known for many years has been sober from meth, but his daughter died of an overdose of heroin and just destroyed him. The problems just don't end with meth. It's a larger systemic problem of people feeling desperate, misdirected, undirected in life, unproductive, and drugs being available to kind of make them feel a bit better.
Jason, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for the invite.
Jason Pine is a professor of anthropology and media studies at Purchase College, State University of New York. His new book is called The Alchemy of Meth, A Decomposition. Wisconsin continues to struggle with high rates of mental illness and suicide among youth. In La Crosse County, 28% of youth are at risk for depression. But as Hope Kerwin reports, a new project is working to lower that number by turning the county into a trauma-informed community.
At Northside Elementary School in La Crosse, a group of 21 moms and their kids have dinner in the cafeteria. One of the moms here, Melissa Alvarez, says raising four kids definitely comes with daily stress. But there's another kind of stress that has stuck with her for much of her life.
My mother passed when I was pretty young, about 16.
Health. but her physical health and her ability to make good decisions.
You're going off of just feeling, and it's like, and it's so hard to like take a step back and like, hold on, wait a minute, let me stop feeling real quick and let me process what's going on and actually think about it.
That's what Alvarez and the other moms at Northside Elementary are here to learn more about. They watch a video on adverse childhood experiences, often called ACEs, and how that trauma can impact their lives and the lives of their kids today.
The impact is on your behavior, it's on your learning, it's on your heart, it's on your DNA. Like, how do you deal with all that stuff?
It's part of a training by Better Together, a program working to improve the mental health of youth in La Crosse County by educating the community about the impacts of trauma. The project is funded by the Medical College of Wisconsin and the Advancing a Healthier Wisconsin Endowment. The idea is to reduce the number of local high school students who report feeling sad or hopeless. Bethany Teer is the project coordinator.
What caused those poor mental health days for our youth? And then at the resiliency science level, looking at what are the best strategies in order to build the resilience, build the coping skills of those youth. And one thing that the science is telling us is that we really need to transform the lives of the adults.
Teer says it's the adults in a kid's day-to-day life who can teach them healthy coping skills and reduce their stress levels, whether they're a parent, neighbor, teacher, or staff at an after-school program. That's why Better Together is providing training for everyone. Teer says more than 1,900 people have already participated. And neighborhood social worker Deborah Dobruns says she sees a change from how local agencies used to help low-income families access resources.
I want you to think about, like, if you went to another country and you were trying to navigate their systems and you didn't understand what all the words meant or what all the things do.
Dobruns says the training has given agencies a shared language to use with families and produce new partnerships, something that's needed as funding for human services becomes more limited.
What we've needed to learn, since there is less money and more need, is how can we work collaboratively or more effectively as a system.
Dobruns says it will take more time and positive experiences for that change to trickle down to families. She's doing her part by frequently talking to parents about their mental health and how it impacts their children. Parents like Mariah Anderson, another mom at the Northside Elementary training. Anderson says these conversations have made her pay more attention to how childhood trauma has impacted her life, especially as she studies for a career in human services.
It actually was this year being in college, like, I'm like, oh my God, like, okay, so this is what depression is. Like, I've been dealing with this for 20 years, you know what I mean? And just having a name to put on those things.
Anderson wants her 8-year-old son, Rashawn, to have a different experience by talking about his mental health now. She plans to start asking him about what is causing him stress.
I know it'll be a lot different, obviously, than like what I would imagine stress to be. He's probably going to be upset about Fortnite or something, you know.
Even if it is a video game, she hopes the conversation will better prepare him to handle stress as he grows up. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And this is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.